This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 83, brought to you in association with Smart Pension, Synchron, and Archover. And I'm delighted to be joined today by Conrad Ford, CEO of Funding Options, to discuss online matchmaking between lenders and borrowers. Conrad was first ennobled by being on the London FinTech podcast back in LFP 020, some 2.5 years ago. There's even a photo of him in the show notes looking young and slim. Creating a startup and making it fly ain't no easy task, dudes, and that ain't no joke. Subsequently, Funding Options entered the long process organised by the UK government to pick three online portals for the mandatory UK SME referral scheme, whereby it has become basically illegal for banks to merely turn down would-be borrowers. Instead, they must refer them, and them here means some hundreds of thousands of businesses per annum, to one of three portals, of which Funding Options is one. I must say that there was huge hype about this before it launched, but I haven't heard much since, and a quick Google on the topic revealed next to naught. So I look forward to hearing what became of that. More broadly, though, the real meat of this area of new financial services is the potential, possibility, and actuality of what a 21st century portal can achieve in lining up the myriad of lenders out there with the millions of SMEs needing finance. I would say, how hard can it be? But I know that it ain't easy. Only in the pages of breathless tech journalism do AI robots march around the world effortlessly fixing every problem. Back in 2014, Funding Options connected SME borrowers to 50 different providers of finance, in one case saving 100 jobs. I wonder what the comparable stats are these days. I'll nail Conrad to the mast and throw him under the bus at the same time in one mixed metaphor by quoting from some of the points he made 2.5 years ago, and he can tell us how things have changed since. There's now a government quarterly survey of some 5,000 SMEs, so the funding behaviour of SMEs is now well understood as opposed to being somewhat anecdotal in the past. Many of the standard media criticisms of banks have been found to be wrong. In round figures, something like 70% of SMEs get turned down for loan referrals, and 40% give up completely at that point. Others, discourage demand, don't even apply in the first place due to perception that the banks won't lend to them. It was generally held that there was a lack of supply of finance. However, this is now known not to be true. There's plenty of money out there seeking high returns. There are plenty of institutions queuing up to lend to SMEs. It was apparent that there was an information gap about how many possibilities are out there. The amount of time it currently takes to do the research oneself is utterly impractical, hence the need for firms like Funding Options. So, plenty to talk about, and let's get on with the show. Hi Conrad, thanks for joining me again today.
Hi Mike, good to be back.
Generally, I like to start this by talking about something far more interesting than fintech, but you didn't appear to know anything about anything. So you have nothing to talk about.
Well, I mean, just prior to the podcast, you asked me if I had any hobbies, and I pointed out that I'm a startup founder, so I don't have any time for any hobbies. So I guess a good thing to talk about would be, well, I guess what's happened in the last 2 years.
What, you mean you're putting on your weight?
Well, I don't believe I put on weight. I think what actually happened is the photo you showed was from 10 years before. Middle age spread has definitely caught me up, but it's very much on my list of things to do when I sell the business and get my yacht and all those things you dream about to lose some weight.
Yes, virtue is always postponed till tomorrow, and vice is easier to slip in today. But one of the things you were trying, actually, last time I saw you, and I fell into this one as well, and it lasted for a while, and I'm going to be virtuous tomorrow, is standing desks. And I read something amazing. Now, this isn't a good idea, but if you suddenly had a standing desk and you stood all day rather than sitting down, it was the equivalent of, and I've actually forgotten the number, but it was an astonishing number. It was the equivalent of, per annum, running 10 marathons in terms of the number of calories you burn by having a standing desk. Now, as you found, and you can tell the listeners, if you suddenly go and stand for hours, actually, you sort of fuck up a different part of your anatomy and you end up with sort of mechanical problems or something. So what happened to the standing desk?
Yeah, so I did experiment with standing desk, and as you allude to, I kind of went all in. The lesson of your middle-aged, I think, is stand in moderation. So I intend to revisit standing desks, but at the moment, somebody with younger life the frame than me is currently using my standing desk, but I do tend to go back to that. I think there's definitely a future in standing desks.
When you were using it, did you find it was good for doing emails, good for getting things done, or good for reading, or you needed to sit down to read? Or
I look at some of my team, particularly my sales team, and they are machines. From the moment they hit their desk to the time they leave, they are constantly working at an amazing pace with amazing energy. I was never that kind of guy. I'm one of these people, I work in bursts. Sometimes I'll work really productively at 10 in the evening and find myself working at 2 in the morning.
And then several months might go before the next burst.
Yeah, well, can we take that out in case my investors listen? But essentially, yeah, for me, it's around a good discipline of having a standing desk, I think, is those times when you're one of those kind of people that can't get yourself to sort of swallow the frog. Is that what the Americans say?
I wouldn't know, and I wouldn't swallow want to. Isn't it lick the frog? That's the sort of psychedelic frog.
No, I think that's a drug-taking thing. I don't do that.
You don't lick frogs.
I think swallowing the frog is when you actually bite off that task you've been throwing back because you can't quite bring yourself to do it. So I think when you need to swallow the frog, there you go, new expression, when you need to swallow the frog is when you need to stand a desk.
There was some awful summer news nonsense about some survey shows on the most hated business lingo these days. And actually, I tended to agree that it was sort of touch base or something was one of the most hated ones. But there's something that I'd never heard of, going back to sort of awful and cruel metaphors towards the animal kingdom, which was punch the puppy.
Punch the puppy.
I'd never heard of this, and Bridget never heard of this either. I mean, I don't think it's a UK expression. So, surprise, surprise, in these sort of cheap newspapers, the survey may not have been so accurate. They weren't talking about swallowing frogs.
Well, actually, sometimes to wind up my team, I sometimes start leading the business in the style of a famous person and see how long it takes to pick up. So my record is actually leading in the style of Captain Jean-Luc Picard of the Federation of Starship Enterprise.
Make it so.
Yeah, make it so. And I managed to get through a whole day without anyone noticing. But my next plan is to do it in the style of Donald Trump. And now I think that will be more difficult to get under the radar.
I see. Right. OK, well, as I was saying in the introduction, it is a very high pressure job. And I'm absolutely not joking on this in being a startup CEO. And people do need holidays every now and then, and it's a bit of a pity you haven't had one for several years, and maybe it'd be quite a good plan. But on the productivity thing, I kind of relate to that to myself, actually, which is that you're right, there are some people who just sort of basically, metaphorically speaking, go to the gym, get on the bike in the morning and pedal all day at a furious rate and then stop. I'm much more the other way around, and perhaps it's a bit like you, which is that I'm extremely good at basically doing exam conditions and doing a ton of stuff, you know, incredibly productively. And I'm extremely good at doing nothing. And I kind of sag in the middle, actually. I'm really bad at sort of 50% tick-over rate. I have to turn 50% into some 100% and some 0%.
Yeah, well, at university, the lack of study that I did and lack of lectures I attended was simply made up by the fact I was formidable at exams. So in those 3 hours, I would come out exhausted and probably a broken man. But I was quite formidable in the 3 hours you had to carry out in the exam. So there you go. I think we have a similar characteristic, which is why we should record podcasts.
That's a non sequitur, but I shall think about that one later. Right, so talking of podcasts, you remind me that it is a podcast. So onto the much more fascinating world, no doubt, of matchmaking, lenders and borrowers, which in principle is incredibly important because in principle, quotes, that's all that finance ever does. This does sort of gloss over the fact that finance actually creates money or banks create money in the middle. So in terms of matchmaking, lenders and borrowers, and absolutely at the centre of finance, I tried to do you a disservice by quoting from your views 2.5 years ago on stuff. Broadly, how has your experience changed of this whole topic, or are you sort of roughly in the same place you were, just doing more of it?
So it's actually been a really exciting time for me at Fund the Options. So I guess 2.5 years ago was probably at the end of a period of pivoting, or going around in circles is probably the more accurate phrase for pivoting. But by that point in time, we kind of knew the business we needed to build, and actually the opportunity is very, very real. There is an extraordinary mismatch in terms of supply of capital and demand for capital, and simply the inability of those two participants to actually meet each other. We've gone through a period of pivoting. We kind of knew the business we needed to build. I think we raised a significant amount of capital probably about 6 months after that. So, you know, we raised money based on that understanding. It's been a period of formidable growth. So in terms of revenues, for example, grew 4 times last year. I think our revenues they've already doubled this year, so they may treble this year by the time the year is out. So it's been a really, really exciting time. And from a sort of personal perspective, you know, kind of one of the learnings that I've taken as a startup founder, in the early days, unless you're one of those businesses, those very, very rare businesses, you know, the funding circles that seem to just get it right first time, you kind of get stuck in a vicious cycle because you simply have too many decisions you have to make at too much of a pace, so you end up making lots of bad decisions. But actually, there's a counterweight to that, which is you get to a point in the business when suddenly most of the business is working, you know, maybe two-thirds of the business is working. And actually you become much more like a sniper and slowly but surely just pick out the issues within the business, whether it's an underperforming leader or it's a particular type of the part of the conversion pipeline or it's a particular aspect of your acquisition. You pick them off one by one. So the corollary is you actually get into a virtuous circle. And it's been a really exciting time. I don't run the business day to day anymore. So I have a managing director running
it. Is this why it's doing better?
I honestly think it's one of the reasons, right? I mean, you know, there comes a time for a business when you need a sales leader, you know, somebody who doesn't come in grumpy half the mornings, who comes in highly energized, you know, highly enthused. I have an amazing guy doing that. And it actually allows me to step back and actually spend my time on thinking about just how big a business we can build. And I'm actually increasingly convinced we can build a very big one indeed.
So that's interesting. And a number of things occur to me. I mean, one of which is, as you say, in a way you learn by doing. You certainly find what the market wants by going out there and just trying stuff. And it's a bit like being a teenager when you start sort of dating. It's only by, you know, going out there and finding out what works that you find out what works and where the demand is. And
yeah, and I think on that point, I'm kind of a textbook example. So I had a corporate strategy background. So for those that didn't listen to the last podcast, I was in the group strategy team of one of the major global banks, Barclays, in fact. So when you come from that background, it's very easy to fall into the trap of thinking, well, for most people, you know, lean startup, first contact with the market, but I'm different. I've got a strategy background, right? I can figure this stuff out. I can jumpstart it. I can piggyback it on desktop research.
You sit there in your exam room going, concentrating on the paper, write down the right answer, and then tell the salesman to go and sell it.
Absolutely. And a real example for funding options is I had an amazing set of data suggesting to me that it was an extraordinary opportunity to open up accountants, practicing accountants as a channel for SME finance. And this wasn't just desktop research surveys. The accountants themselves were telling me just how enthused they were about the idea. In reality, that was a really, really hard thing to do, and I kind of wasted a year of my life on trying to push that, when in reality, first contact with the market should have given me the lesson. So it's actually very important when you come from that corporate background to, you know, don't think you're different. You know, the lean startup principles, as long as you have regulatory compliance, in other words, as long as what you're doing you're allowed to do, get into the market fast. Yes. Always the case.
Yes, and I mean, just fast forwarding to where you ended up, I mean, by definition and joking apart, the correct implementation is to go back to the strategy at the senior level once you've built the machine, which is tactically executing day by day. And those skill sets are different. And we were talking last week with Steve Husk of Cloud Margin, who's got probably about some 40 years off and on in the IT industry in FS. And his experiences of this and creating structure and in terms of phase changes from startup to scale up and then growth company, which only a few fintechs, I think, are in sort of true growth mode at the moment, like some Monzos and Revolut, perhaps, you know, getting on for half a million or more than half a million clients. That's certainly a growth company that once you've got to that stage, you're not going to find anybody who's actually really good at, as you put it, smiling and dialing every day. But at the same time, taking a step back and thinking, where are we going wrong? What could we be doing differently over the next couple of years? And I think the other thing that I was listening to you talking about what you've been doing, this is a tangent, we won't go down this particular rabbit hole, but I've been watching a series of lectures online by Professor Jordan Peterson, who does psychology at the University of Toronto, which is, I think, one of the two best in North America on psychology or something like that. He puts all of his courses online, so I'm watching his one-year course to undergraduates on personality and its transformations, and if anybody's listening is interested, I particularly recommend the one where he does a Jungian analysis of The Lion King. I haven't actually seen The Lion King, but I want to see The Lion King now, and it was like, it took about 2.5 hours, and I thought it was a cartoon, but how much he took out of it. And in particular, one of his themes that he's spoken about quite a lot is, also this is kind of from a Jungian perspective, is archetypes and the meaning of stories and all this kind of stuff. And I learned quite a lot about St. George and the Dragon and other similar stories and what the metaphorical meaning of that is, which is that the sort of dragon symbolises threat, disorder, chaos. But the interesting thing, and again, I've never thought about this, is that dragons tend to have either kidnapped a virgin or be sitting on a pot of gold. I mean, the Hobbit's a good example. They're sitting on a pot of gold. Well, that's a bit strange. Why would a dragon collect a pot of gold and virgins? Well, the answer is that, you know, the time that these stories came about, those are things you'd want. You'd want a wife, a young, fertile wife, to have lots of kids so to support you in your old age when there wasn't pensions going around, or you might need the money. And these stories have been around for thousands and thousands of years. And his interpretation of this, which makes a lot of sense to me, which is that the dragon represents chaos, it represents the unknown, it represents the things you're frightened of. But you need to go through that to get what you need. And in terms of this unformed chaos, you know, we all live in this kind of walled garden, but beyond that, beyond our sort of comfort zone, if you like, is all the things that we need to grow into. And the way to kill a dragon is you slice it up into little bits. And the slicing up into little bits amounts to creating order out of chaos. So you sat there 2.5 years ago, let's go back in a time machine, with what you had at the time, you were surrounded by this field of potential, which you couldn't particularly name. You had a nebulous feel over, you weren't quite sure. Going into it would make you feel uncomfortable, all that kind of stuff. But actually by expanding, literally in this case, the boundaries of your empire, by structuring it and ordering it, putting farms here, reclamation plants there, you've then created a bigger city. And then you can come back and, you know, you can be the king of the city that you've created. But it's this really ordering the chaos, which applies to everything in our lives, whether it's relationships or having families or fintech.
That is a good analogy. I mean, just to sort of make that real. So when you look at our market in the UK, about £15 billion a year of finance is introduced by brokers. The vast majority of that is very traditional brokers.
Do you happen to know what the total is? And so 15 billion of what?
The total would be about 75 billion of SME finance.
Quite a lot.
Yeah, a significant proportion, but the vast majority is direct to bank. But essentially, when you look at that market, well, actually, the bit that we particularly have majored in as a business is working capital finance, where we have, well, we still have less than 5% of the introduced market, but we're probably now the biggest introducer in the market. But the key point there is we have a very clear plan and very executable plan to make that 10% or maybe 20%. So in other words, somebody else's job is to make that happen, to make, you know, make that division of the business, you know, four times bigger, eight times bigger. We kind of know how to do that. We just need to do the same thing at much bigger scale. And at that point in time, we would have created an introducer in the market of a scale that the world has never seen. Yeah. But the key point is our bit of working capital finance is actually a fraction of the 15 billion. And when you actually look at the breakdown of that market, asset finance, so financing trucks, machinery, print machines, etc., construction vehicles, that is a huge, huge market. It's much bigger than the one we're in now. So I spend my time thinking about how am I going to go after that market, because we're going to need a different business model. We're going to need a different structure. So it is exactly that thing. You know, we've actually chopped up one leg of the dragon. But in reality, when you actually step back and spend time looking at it, you suddenly realize there's a much bigger prize to go for. And it's that kind of incremental process is very important to building a successful startup. You know, fintech has been overhyped, and I don't think the bubble is bursting, but it certainly has deflated a bit or lost a bit of its froth. The business that I have right now, I could make this business profitable within 3 to 6 months if I had to do so. We are that close now. We just need to take out some of the startup stuff, you know, maybe flog some of our beanbags. We could make this business profitable, and getting that point where you know you have a real business there is really, really important. And I think a lot of the overhyped startups are a very, very long way from that. When in reality, you always want to be that one punch away from profitability, because you never quite know when this world is going to end.
Yes, absolutely. And just finishing off on the metaphor, I mean, it occurred to me that what I didn't make clear, and actually I don't think Jordan Peterson particularly makes it clear, is that chaos means different things in the West and in the East. Chaos in the West tends to mean everybody's running around going wild. In the East, it's got much more of a sense of unformed and infinite potentiality in the way that a large block of marble has for a sculptor. A large block of marble contains every possible shape, or a blank sheet of paper contains every possible story. And so that's what you're taking when you're going round your loop. You're then approaching a new area. You've got no words for it, and you sit down and order it in your strategic way. So that makes a lot of sense to me. Okay, well, diving in then to decompose this topic, you've explained where you guys have come from and how it's going, and it does start to sound like, I mean, one way I think about this, ironically, given the name of the podcast, is that once you can stop using the word fintech, you're a business. So what do? You match lenders and borrowers, and you do whatever it is, a trillion or a billion or whatever it is per annum. Oh, that's a business. You know, nothing particularly sort of fintech. You don't have to sort of hang out with people in different segments of it. So decomposing the marketplace, and we've got lenders, what lenders are up to and all that kind of stuff. I mean, one reason I think fintech took off was particularly the time George Osborne, the Conservatives, given the Basel III changes and all that kind of stuff, lenders were having to cut back for capital reasons, and they were very keen to promote anything which involved sort of money coming into the market to stop the economy collapsing. So that was what was happening then. And you've got borrowers, and then you guys in the middle. So starting with the lenders then, where has lending been going the last few years, and where do you see it going forward? And how do you break, in your own mind, just briefly, lenders into the various subcategories of lenders, for example, like big banks like Barclays, or just sort of new fintechs like Zopas? Or
the key themes over the last 2-3 years, I mean, I would reiterate something that I was saying a couple of years ago, which is that there was certainly a misperception then that was a lack of supply of capital to lend to SMEs here in the UK. Well, in reality, there's plenty of supply. There was there then, and there's more now. When you look at how the markets have changed during that period, well, first and foremost, the traditional high street banks are very much back in the market. So, you know, we can argue till the cows come home just how much they walked away from the market after the global financial crisis. But they're back in the market now. And I would actually argue they're back in the market in a very, very mature way. You know, it's kind of Goldilocks. It's not too hot, not too cold, because they were doing some really, really stupid lending in the run-up to the global financial crisis, you know, particularly with commercial property. They'd forgotten the difference between equity and debt. The kind of lending they're doing is very, very mature. But the world has kind of moved on. A very good example there would be there's lots of traditional manufacturing firms around the country which got caught out during the global financial crisis because they had all of their machinery or whatever they had, their premises, was all leveraged up by one bank, one of the big high street banks. Then suddenly, for the first time in their life, they got a no when they asked for more finance. And they suddenly realized, you know, we need to be looking for alternatives. I think a really important point there is a lot of those traditional firms, they opened the doors to new lenders during that period, and they've kept the door open, even though they can get everything they want from their bank, they've kind of learned the lesson. So I think we're seeing a world where there's a growing understanding amongst SMEs, particularly the larger ones, that there is a whole world of alternatives out there. It may be a bit more expensive, but it's often more flexible, it's often more reliable, it's often a lot faster. So there's a growing awareness of the alternatives out there. In terms of characterizing the alternative lending market, in our world or fintech bubble, there is a massive overemphasis of peer-to-peer. Peer-to-peer has been an important component of SME lending, but actually the new challenger banks that have come about, you know, the Aldermores, the Shawbrooks, they've actually pumped out far more money than peer-to-peer to SMEs in the same period, and they came about at the same time. A good example there is Oak North, a new challenger bank. I think they've done £600 million of lending in their first 2 years. That's a speed of lending that makes peer-to-peer look pedestrian.
So just pressing pause on that one, because it's an interesting point. I mean, as I've increasingly mentioned, I see fintech as just a code word for what's happening to financial services as a result of sort of digital hitting it. I mean, digital hit the media a long time ago and it sort of messed that up a bit. And digital is changing financial services as a whole. Now, I think I take a fairly extreme view of the likes of Zopa becoming a bank. The fact is that in 2005, basically, Zopa did invent worldwide peer-to-peer lending. Didn't really exist before that in any meaningful sense. And they were the first peer-to-peer for some time. And then more recently, they're becoming, becoming a bank or setting up a subsidiary of a bank. And I actually read that as something of throwing in the towel that P2P did not meet its promise. And the promise of peer-to-peer was by having something leaner in between buyer and seller, in between lender and borrower, you could actually outperform banks, which have got a huge cost base, and they have to have a huge cost base. Now, the fact that that hasn't worked in the way it was originally intended says to me that actually the premise wasn't true, or rather the fact that banks can gear up 10 times or whatever it is means that a fintech would have to be 10 times better. What's your view on that spectrum? Do you think it actually shows that peer-to-peer is wonderful or becoming a bank, or do you think it shows it's a failure or somewhere in the middle?
Well, definitely somewhere in the middle. I certainly would very strongly push back on language like throwing in the towel. My argument would be that peer-to-peer is kind of a first baby step on a natural transformation of the market, which is that all financial services providers, particularly in the lending and saving side of things, are fundamentally just intermediaries that connect pools of capital that want it with pools of capital that provide it. Now, our traditional high street banks, there's nothing fundamentally wrong with the economics of their capital structures. In fact, they're very compelling. The problem with our high street banks is that they have enormous bureaucracies, enormous headcounts. You know, and we've had meetings with these banks where they've turned up with more than my entire headcount. It's insane. So there's nothing fundamentally wrong with the structure of the bank. For me, peer-to-peer was kind of a, you know, let's do this in a much more direct way. Let's literally take thousands of individuals that want money and thousands of individuals that have money and say, you guys should meet.
That's true. But if that worked as well as it was supposed to work a few years ago, then why would you ever need to set up a bank?
That's exactly my point, actually, Mike, which is that that works very well with early adopters who get excited about this kind of stuff. You know, the kind of people who they've got a bit of experience of finance. They love sitting there. You know, it keeps them, you know, keeps them from the golf course. They sit there and buy the things. That was never an inherently scalable model. What we've actually seen, of course, is the evolution of peer-to-peer to marketplace lending, where large chunks of that capital is institutional money. So for me, peer-to-peer in its purest sense was an interesting first step. But actually, fundamentally, when you step back from it, the market I'm in is bizarre. And this is something that massively excites me, actually. We have a huge oligopoly, yeah, that the participants of the oligopoly don't particularly want to have. Yeah. How often does that happen? Yeah. The major banks here in the UK, they absolutely dominate SME lending because SMEs only go to them for finance, when in reality, the economics of actually serving the smaller businesses are increasingly unattractive. You know, relationship banking only works for 1 million turnover and above, McKinsey statistic recently. Well, actually, the vast majority of businesses fall out of that. So actually, all participants, including the major banks, would actually like a bit more diversity in this market. But the key point is, fundamental to all of this is connecting pools of capital, and peer-to-peer is one way of achieving that, but in reality, in its purest sense, it's probably not as scalable as people thought.
Yes, well, I certainly agree with the last point, and we don't want to get bogged down on the P2P, because as you say, it's a tiny percentage still of what's in the market. And I absolutely respect the leaders who have created a market out of thin air. I mean, I think there's just a couple of points I would make. And the first is that it's a very common economic mistake to say that banks connect borrowers and lenders. They absolutely don't do that. Banks create, for the sake of argument, 90% of the money quotes out of thin air in the middle. And this is a really important thing which keeps coming up time and time again at the New City Agenda.
But they do collect deposits, right? They may leverage them up, but it's the collection of deposits. It's the crucial aspect that a bank has that nobody else has. That's the crucial point.
Well, no, the one thing the bank has that nobody else has is the ability to create money. If funding options start creating money tomorrow, you'll get arrested and thrown in jail, and this will be a complete waste of a podcast. The bank's function is to create money. Private banks create money in America, in the UK. It wasn't always like that, but it is now. That's the one thing that it can do. But anyway, putting that economic kind of economic thing to one side, for the sake of argument, you're right. They take a pound of deposit, but I'm also right. They create £9, and then they lend out £10 on the other side. But I think more practically, and to some point I made some time ago, and nobody particularly took it up, which is that if you look at the early days of banking, by which I probably mean sort of medieval Italy and bankrupt was bankrupto, you know, they broke the table when they went bankrupt. If you look at what happened, it wasn't particularly a good plan then, but what evolved over the centuries was this thing called the interbank market, where we all get together and we all help each other kind of stuff. Because as a bank, you've either got too many borrowers or too many lenders by definition. And of course the P2Ps have, and they've always had this, and this has always been their moan. But actually, in banking, that got turned into a positive, which they all got together and, oh, do you know what? You've got too much left hand and too little right hand. And I've got the opposite. Oh, well, switch it around. And then actually, suddenly, you get a network effect, ironically, for the world that talks about network effects. They're not doing it in P2P. And the whole thing becomes much more powerful. Now, ironically, that started to happen in peer-to-peer, insofar as those with surplus of funds would lend to other peer-to-peers, you know, a vestigial interbank market on the peer-to-peer. But that got knocked on the head by the regulator, who said, thou shalt not do that kind of thing. And so the two things that means that banking works, if every bank just stood on its own 2 feet and did precisely what you said without an interbank market, they would find it incredibly hard to do what they need to do. They would find it impossible to do what they need to do. But instead, the interbank market means they can switch out the surpluses. And also, the banks have this ability to transfer maturities, which peer-to-peer never developed. So actually, I do think there is still a chance, although the regulation makes it very hard, for peer-to-peers to create an inter-peer-to-peer market and somehow some kind of maturity transformation that fits in with the regulatory thing. Now, in the way the world works at the moment, that probably means you have to become a bank to do that. I.e. the logical extension of a peer-to-peer market.
Just to be clear, I remain a strong fan of peer-to-peer, which is why I push back on your comment around throwing in the towel. The critical point I'm making is that it kind of doesn't matter whether you get your money from 100 investors giving you £1,000 or whether you take a £100,000 block facility from a bank or from another financial institution. It kind of doesn't matter. And I would also make the observation SMEs kind of don't care, right? In fact, some of them are quite worried about the fact that, you know, thousands of anonymous individuals get to look at their financial statements that they, generally speaking, are very, very reticent about sharing with anybody, including the taxman. So for that very reason, the point I'm making is it kind of doesn't matter where that money comes from, particularly to the end user of that money.
That's clearly completely correct. You know, if I'm trying to borrow money to buy a house, then I don't really care. So, OK, so that's the lenders, which is that it's normalised a little bit more, and we're probably in the middle of a credit cycle if the lending is, quotes, sensible, unquotes, because by definition at the end of a cycle it always becomes less sensible. And you've touched on the borrowers there and said that they don't really mind too much where the money comes from at a first approximation. The challenge we were talking about before, which is clearly where funding options comes into, which is that if I'm a small SME, and for the sake of argument, define here a small SME as somebody who doesn't have a dedicated full-time finance director, I ain't going to know much about these millions of people out there and all their individual situations.
Yeah. If you want to characterise the borrower market, again, we have a return to normality. I think, again, demand is not too hot and not too cold. If I was the government and there was one thing that would keep me awake at night around SME finance, it's this. As you watch the evolution of our economy, this is true, I guess, of most developed economies, but particularly true of the UK, we are more and more generating our GDP from service sector industries. And that matters for a really profound and important point. Traditional businesses, whether they're farms or manufacturers or any of those more traditional industries, they have physical assets. They will often own their premises. They will certainly have some tractors or machinery, or they might have some trucks. These are the absolute basis on which traditional lenders will lend. People characterize the banks, sometimes unfairly, as being like pawnbrokers, you know. They lend against assets, whether it's new assets or asset refinance. Well, actually, as we shift towards a service sector economy, our businesses are increasingly, you know, bearded hipsters doing cool design stuff. These businesses, like mine, they're in shared office spaces. They rent a unit with 3 months' notice. They have the odd computer, and their key asset is their staff or their brand. These businesses cannot be financed through asset as a security, and we must unlock that. And actually, most of the growth of alternative finance that is sustainable, I would argue, is actually new ways that have attacked that problem of helping those businesses that don't tick the boxes of traditional businesses. The stuff that's really sustainable, you know, when all the VC money goes away, is new ways of underwriting, you know, whether it's tapping into accounting software or open banking APIs, new clever algorithmic ways of lending that find new security or new ways to actually safely advance money to businesses. That's the biggest problem emerging, particularly for the UK, but I suggest around the world as well.
And so, without going into a sort of hypey cliche, in the past we've had, and we still do, of course, lending against assets, and this has been noticed in recent times as being a source of financial instability. So one of the canards about banks is that they lend for investment. Well, as Lord Turner points out time and time again, 70 or 80% of bank lending is not for investment. It's against pre-existing assets to finance a competition over price, the best example being the housing in the UK, where it's financed a massive housing boom. Traditionally, banks, of course, like security. Why wouldn't you? If you're a bank who can lend money and didn't want to get the sack, didn't want to lose the money, you would. So, but what you're talking about here is as we go from a manufacturing era into an information era, that going forward, in a sense, your literally security of your loan and your job is related to superior processing of information. If you can see through the information flows on the other side, in particular the financial flows, you have some idea of whether, God, that's a bit of a risky loan. Look at that. You know, their income comes and goes, or actually this is fairly sort of stable. And I think you're, of course, quite right. Market Invoice always comes to my mind as a firm that has got a comparative advantage in areas of intellectual property and that kind of stuff compared to the banks. And part of that, of course, is actually, in a sense, this is why fintechs becoming banks is a bit of a challenge, is regulatory arbitrage, because the Basel III rules are the Basel III rules. So what you say is completely true, but if you're a bank and Basel III says, lending to a design shop is a million times capital because there's no asset, well, that's the way it is.
Yeah, and I think the particular impact of Basel III is on SME overdrafts. We've done some work on this ourselves, and this is based on Bank of England data. This is uncontestable. So SME overdrafts were falling at a rate of £5 million a day for a number of years in the UK. I mean, that's an extraordinary statistic. When you think about it, that's like a huge vacuum that's sucking working capital out of UK PLC, or the backbone of the UK economy, as the SMEs tend to get called. And that is not the bank's fault, right? You know, these regulations were put in place to make our banks safer after the global financial crisis. But actually, lots and lots of the successful fintech alt-fi, in other words, the ones that really feel like they're going to be profitable and sustainable, they're basically doing short-term lending to actually step into that gap. So one of the things that you see a lot of, and Market Invoice is one example, but iWaka is another example, is essentially a business traditionally might have had a nice fat overdraft that they might have regularly used. And then actually coming to the end of the cycle, suddenly the bank would realise the business has always fully utilised its overdraft. And just at the point when the business can't pay it back, they make this belated realisation. We saw a farm a few years ago that had £1 million of turnover and £500,000 overdraft that was fully maxed out. Yeah, I mean, that business could never pay that back. So what you see now is quite transactional cash, where businesses, as and when they need money, they go and transactionally get that money. And I think that's a great opportunity. As you say, there's a degree of regulatory arbitrage from the lack of or the withdrawal of committed facilities other than invoice finance, which remains very much an active market.
Interesting. And so just on the matchmaking, a couple of questions just to wrap up this thing. I mean, I think we've raised some interesting topics and hopefully put some views on both sides. And, you know, the reality is that we don't know what it's going to be like in a year's time or a year after. And it could go this way or could go the other in terms of how these things develop. I mentioned, or you mentioned 2.5 years ago, that you connected up to 50 lenders. I mean, is that you're still doing 50 now, or you're doing 5 million lenders?
No, I mean, we still have an active panel of in the region of 50 lenders, actually. That's kind of a natural level. Our market, as in many areas of fintech, is one where vanity statistics are quite common. So, you know, how many businesses have come to you for finance, or how many lenders you work with. In reality, we are, by an order of magnitude, the largest online SME finance aggregator by an order of magnitude. So ours is the proven business model. We find a natural level of competitive tension. So when you go down to a really specific subsector of SME finance, so let's say single invoice finance, financing a single invoice like Market Invoice do, it's natural to have maybe 3 or 4 lenders. So you're an important introducer to them. There's always one that's underperforming and about to be kicked off, and there's always one coming in that's really hungry to get your business. So we find that's a natural level where we are probably the largest introducer, for example, to the peer-to-peer SME finance market now. We find we build deep, sustained relationships with SME finance providers. They consider us to be an important part of their acquisition strategy, and they treat our customers accordingly. And so that number is kind of sustained over time. It's a natural number.
You're really, in a sense, just, I mean, I don't mean the word just in a negative way, but you're really, in a sense, your business model is basically a 21st century digitalized broker. Brokers have always been around for centuries.
Yeah, I mean, of course, I mean, we are actually regulated as a credit broker, so there you go.
Oh, well, there we go. That's a coincidence.
It is a simple statement of fact. I mean, we wouldn't be able to trade if we weren't regulated as such. If you look at our market, so I alluded earlier on that there's £15 billion a year of property, asset and working capital finance originated by brokers. And if you look at that market, it's rapidly aging. It's struggling to deal with online behaviours. More and more SMEs are going online. And importantly, the FCA is increasingly taking a serious look at SME finance as a category. For those reasons, you've got thousands of traditional brokers are struggling, and they're also rapidly aging. So, you know, you've got a population that's not being replaced. I would estimate about £1 billion a year of origination will disappear in the market from now for the next 10 years, £1 billion a year. And the only thing that can step in and fill that gap is a next generation credit broker or an online business finance marketplace like ourselves that is highly compliant, designed for the online expectations of SMEs and designed to scale at a level that's never been seen before. So, you know, that's the opportunity that we're going after as a business.
Interesting. So just touching on it, it may have been that my Google wasn't in a particularly good mood the other day, but when I typed in UK government SME referral scheme, how's it going, Google, I didn't really get anything back.
Yeah, so the bank referral scheme, for those that aren't aware, the UK government passed a law, believe it or not, a couple of years ago that said from a point in time, if a major bank in the UK rejected an SME for finance, they would be legally required to offer them a referral to alternative finance providers. So this is the government's attempt to actually unlock this terrible tragedy that of the minority of businesses that get rejected when they apply to their bank for finance, a very important word, minority. The majority of those give up if they get rejected. They simply give up. They don't explore the alternative finance market. So that scheme actually launched right at the end of last year. So we're now barely 6 months in. Launched without hitch, I think, was a really important point. You know, you're talking about 9 banks and 3 businesses like ourselves. Launched without hitch, we financed the first bank referral in history within days of the launch of the scheme, which is really exciting. The scheme has been something of a success. The government actually was planning to do some press around it, but actually the election got in the way. The government in the UK doesn't do press during elections for obvious reasons. So we will be getting some updates on that. But it's been a good start. Funding options alone has financed millions of pounds for SMEs. I would draw analogies to the bank appeals process, which was brought in about 5 years ago. This is a process where when a bank rejected a business for finance, they would voluntarily offer them an appeal. That scheme actually kicked off 5 years ago. It had a modest, steady start. Now more than £100 million of finance has actually been accessed for SMEs that wouldn't have otherwise happened. And I think we're on a very similar trajectory here. And it's the bank appeals process in 5 years has become an established part of the SME finance infrastructure, despite lots of naysayers in the early days. And I think we're seeing the same thing. It's going to be another component. And bit by bit, you unlock this issue of the SMEs that simply give up when they're rejected by their bank for finance.
Excellent. So it's a very good example of where the government is improving the economy at a microeconomic level through fairly simple means, and as you say, it has a practical import, and I look forward to seeing that press release with the actual numbers on it. Before we wrap up the show and ask Conrad what he needs for Christmas and next year's birthday present, I'd love to thank all the listeners out there. We just passed 250,000 downloads, 3 years birthday for the LFP recently, and 8,400 LinkedIn views of that, which was very nice. I'd also like to thank my brand partners for the podcast. Archover, secured peer-to-peer business lending, connecting businesses requiring finance with investors seeking a secure and favourable return of up to 9% per annum. Smart Pension, who are fast, secure and free. Check out their UK workplace pensions at autoenrolment.co.uk. Synchron, digital business consulting and technology services for top-tier FS. From startup to 7,000 people, 18 countries and $400 million of revenue. So we've spoken quite a bit in the meantime about funding options, mention it more than once in passing, or not in passing, as the case may be. So briefly, where are you going and what do you need for Christmas? What does Santa Claus need to bring you to make next year even greater than where you are this year?
One thing that I'll point out is the UK, once again, actually, from a regulatory perspective, is some way ahead of Europe, as it is with open banking and PSD2, because within the Capital Markets Union Action Plan, It's something that looks very similar to the government's bank referral scheme that we have here in the UK. With that in mind, I'm very excited about the opportunities across Europe, and I will actually be launching funding options across Europe from next year. So if anyone out there works for a continental European bank, we'd love to be in touch with you. We would love to work with you on actually accessing alternative finance for your customers.
Excellent. So you presumably got to do that before sort of Brexit's or doesn't Brexit or something like that, or actually none of us actually quite know what's going on. And I get very bored, like most people, are reading sort of the day-to-day tittle-tattle.
I was actually in a private roundtable, so I won't go into too much detail, but between ministers and some fintech businesses. And actually one of the things that really stood out to me is a lot of the fintech businesses didn't understand what can and cannot be passported.
In the first place?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Even where we are today.
So they seem to think they were losing something that they didn't already have. So a very good example there is, you know, to the extent that we have a regulatory environment, it's consumer credit. Consumer credit is not passported. So it may be in the future. I may lose something in the future. I'm not losing anything now. So I think potentially the impacts of Brexit on fintech in the UK are probably overstated.
Interesting. Well, I think that's a good hardcore point, because you see all sorts of misinformation in the mainstream media. And in terms of finance being a social construct, the thing that just increasingly strikes me this year is how the boundary conditions, as it were, are just constantly changing, whether it's Brexit, which is an obvious one, but all the regulations and the evolution of MIFIDs and this, that and the other. So it really is a kind of world in which, whether you're small, medium or large in financial services, you need to be running to stand still. And so it's to your great credit, Conrad, that even though you're not standing still so much at your desk, you're sitting still, that you've come as far as you have in the last 2.5 years. And I'm sure if I went back and told you what you're about to go through 2.5 years ago, you'd be A, horrified at the pain you had to go through, but B, very gratified at the level of success that came your way. And I think it really is summed up by the idea that nothing succeeds like persistence, along with keeping your eyes and ears open and changing tack along the way. And that's not a cliche, is it?
I'm often asked for advice by people who want, you know, people who are bored in their bank in the city and they want to go and do fintech. And actually, I say,
don't.
Actually, I don't. I'm a great believer in fintech. What I say is, I just think fintech's always been around, right? You know, it's always been there. It's now got a name. What I always say, you know, it's a bit like Rocky, the Rocky films, right? Rocky wins because every time he gets punched, he gets back up again, right? It's a bit like Rocky. That's the life of a startup founder, right? And actually, you know, you have to be extraordinarily tenacious and you have to take the punches. But fundamentally, if the market opportunity you're going after is real and you're not completely thick, eventually you'll get there.
That reminds me of something I saw Peter Thiel say, which was an interesting one. And he said that he sees students or graduates, undergraduates or whatever, and, you know, a lot of them put on the what do you want to do thing. I want to be an entrepreneur. And Peter Thiel, founder of PayPal and early investor in Google and Facebook and all sorts of huge successes like that, he says you absolutely have to be crazy to be an entrepreneur, because it's a really tough lifestyle to have. Why would you do that? He said there's only one reason, which is that there's a real problem out there in the world that you want to solve, and that's the only way to solve it. Just being an entrepreneur for the sake of it is a sort of act of self-harm or masochism. Right, on that note, so all of you in incumbents or in fintechs who want to do something different, I think Conrad's advice is absolutely go for it. But he would say, and I would double up on that one, which is that you better make sure it's a real thing to make it worth all the pain. So thank you very much for that, Conrad, and I look forward to seeing how things go in the next 2.5 years and connecting and matchmaking lenders and borrowers.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. If you have consulting, advisory/non-exec or media needs in the FS or fintech space, get in touch with me at mike@londonfintechpodcast.com.
Could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. Come away from the city, with the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, with the are wild, like the mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me. 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 Watch the firelight dance.